Well, thank you for the introducing words. And also, I'm talking about mid-infrared spectroscopy, and today I'd like to concentrate on the rapid assessment, not of solorganic, bulk solorganic carbon, but on solorganic carbon pools. So our salts contain more than 2 times the amount of carbon than is contained in our atmosphere, and more than 3 times the amount of carbon in the vegetation that's growing on the soil. So it's quite an issue if, and really if, to what amount soil carbon, atmospheric carbon, could be stored in soil organic matter. And mathematical modeling already contributed a lot to our understanding in soil organic carbon dynamics. And it was in 1994 when Jens Kjernstedt, oh, that's 2004, I thought it was 1994, so whatever. when they discovered that you could actually initialize and validate soil organic carbon turnover model by using measured carbon fractions. So these guys, they determined the soil organic carbon, the black carbon as a passive pool, and the particulate organic carbon as a fast cycling pool, and calculated the chemified organic carbon by difference. And then they took these pools and they also considered physical and chemical protection by clay, ferrous oxides, and also under consideration of soil moisture and temperature. These soil carbon fraction appeared to be a practical measure for CO2 emission or for soil organic carbon dynamics on a particular soil. But nature is not that simple. What about spatial variability? And that's the point where the classical methods for estimation of these carbon pools is the limitation, because you need a huge number of soil samples to cover spatial variability. And that's the point where now mid-infrared spectroscopy comes into play. As we already heard, it's fast, it's cheap, and we know that we can access soil organic carbon. And so if we also could get these different soil organic carbon pools, like black carbon or particulate organic carbon, then we had a key to access also spatial variability of soil organic carbon turnover. And that's what we really need. So the site where we took some samples, or that we used to try to elucidate if we can access this carbon fraction, is in Germany, of course. So that's near Aachen in the let's call the Midwest of Germany. And we have a much smaller space now. It's just 60 times 180 meter large, this plot, and we sampled it in a 10 times 10 meter raster. These are less dominated soils, and their parts of them are covered by fluvial deposits. So there's a lot of coarse textured and gravelly, high gravel contents in this upper area here. So down here we have about like 3% of gravels, and here it's about 50%. Yes, as you already saw here, I stretched this a little bit so that it gets more obvious that there's some aspect in it, but just for a better view. Okay, so the soils, they cover skeletic leptosols here in the upper area, then we have combi soils about here in the middle, and alluvisols at the bottom of this site. And yeah, we did, of course, mid-infrared spectroscopy, and the infrared spectra that I measured looked like this. So this is just the mid-infrared range, spanning from about 4,000 to 400 or 500 wave numbers. And as you see, there are some specific peaks in this, but it's not easy to make any quantitative estimations from these spectra, because they are too similar. And so you use partial least squares regression. We heard about that. And I'd like to shortly explain some main mechanisms of this procedure, because that's important for some later slides. So if you have a sample set now of just two soils, and we now imagine that these spectra just have two main peaks or main signals, then we could decompose this spectra set into two loadings. The first loading just representing the first peak, the second loading just representing the second peak. And now the partial least square regression will also create so-called PLS factors. And with the use of these factors, you can recombine every spectra of the original data set to, you can recombine it from the loadings, just multiplying by the factors. And the PLS now forces uses the lab data, let's say, of solid organic carbon or the individual carbon pools. And the covariance between the factors and the lab data is maximized. So there is a chemical meaning forced into the loadings. So you can interpret them. So if you take a look at the loadings, then you see what kind of chemical information the model is using. And that's important. We heard already that there is soil organic carbon, that this can be predicted, and we predicted some other things on this particular site. As you see, we get a good estimate of soil organic carbon, and then did the black carbon thing, that's already 3 years ago or something, and then we did the lignin and clay content, silt, sand, clay, that worked for this particular site very good, as it is smaller, so you can you don't have so many other influence parameters that will disturb your prediction, and it's makes it easier on a small scale. But today I'd like to concentrate on the particulate organic matter, as I consider it to be most important for small timescale carbon storage. So it's an indicator if you store carbon. So how did we gain the particulate organic matter? We took a sieved salt sample, that's sieved to 2,000 micrometers, and then we applied some ultrasonic energy to it, and by wet sieving we separated the so-called POM1, I'll call it POM1 fraction, that's 2,000 to 250 micrometer. Then we applied some more ultrasound to the rest of the sample, and then we got the POM2 and the POM3, that's with decreasing aggregate or particle size. And now, if you want to predict individual fractions of particulate organic matter from a bulk soil sample, then you need to have two things. The first thing is, you have to be sure that the individual carbon fractions are really chemically distinct from another. And the second thing is, you need to know that infrared spectroscopy really sees these differences. And so to prove this, we did the following. So in the first step, I just took the fractions, the separated fractions, and just predict the soil organic carbon content within these fractions. And then I took a look at the PLSR loadings that were used in the models to predict the carbon content for the fractions, and then I compare these factor loadings to the prediction models where the whole soil sample was scanned, and I predicted the amount of carbon in the particular particulate organic matter fraction that was actually stored in this bulk soil sample. And in the next slide, we will see the factor loadings. The first factor loading for the prediction models for the individual fraction. So this is just a soil organic carbon prediction within the three fractions. And we see some characteristic wavelengths here. So the aliphatic groups, which are primary decomposition products during decomposition, they are not found in the coarse fractions, but they come here in the POM2 and in the POM3. They're quite a bit, but they seem already to disappear again. Then another example is just carboxylic groups. There's the strongest peak here in the POM3, and there's almost nothing here in the POM1. So this might be considered as microbial decomposition products or metabolites. So, and there's a third example here. That's the cellulose around about 1,000 wave numbers. and we see in the undecomposed cellulose that huge peak, and then it's slowly disappearing, and there's almost nothing in the POM3. So we have characteristic loadings for individual POM fractions. So actually, mid-infrared spectroscopy is able to see differences in the organic carbon in these different particulate organic matter fractions. And now, if we take a look, what's happening if we look at the factor loadings of the prediction models from the where we try to predict the particulate organic matter from bark soil, then we see identical cyanols. We see here the aliphates most strongly here in the POM2 and also in the POM3. Then the carboxylic groups are here, the largest, and the cellulose dominates the POM1 and it disappears. So we have a match in the PLSR in the factor loadings, and this is an indirectly proof that this is not some kind of hocus pocus. So like we put something in and see what's coming out. But this is really a chemical proof that this is actually working. And that's the second step after just statistical parameters. So now we know that we can predict these fractions. Let's take a look at the spatial distribution. And so these are just spatial maps of the spatial distribution of soil organic carbon. And we see that there's more soil organic carbon here in the upper areas with high stoniness. So this is gravelly soil. And down here, it's much less. So we have about 1.7% up here, and it's about 0.9 to 1% soil organic carbon down here. So traditionally, clay contents were thought to heavily influence soil organic carbon contents. But as you see from the clay content map, this doesn't work quite well. So there has to be something else going on here. And then the second factor that you would consider is the ferrous oxides, as here determined by dithionite carbonate bicarbonate methods. And you already get an impression that this is working a bit better, but especially here where the high soil organic carbon concentrations are apparent, then it starts to scatter, and maybe that's also not so good. Now, the third map that's here compared with the soil organic carbon shows the stone content. And actually, the stone content almost perfectly matches the soil organic carbon content on this particular site. And this is also expressed by this really good R square. And if you now wonder what is going on here, then you have to take a look at the individual particulate organic matter fractions. And then you see something like this. The coarse particulate organic matter has the strongest relation to the stone content. And this is diminishing with diminishing particle size. So you could get the impression that some kind of saturation thing is happening here, probably because the POM3 fraction is already kind of saturated, or because it's dry, or it's a lot of carbon input into the soil that's not so fast decomposed, and then coarse undecomposed fractions accumulate. So this is some kind of indication maybe for hierarchical saturation. Also, the other parameters, of course, have an influence, and you see this if I did multiple regression analysis, and there you see that the non-POM, so that's everything that's not particulate organic matter, so mostly mineral-bound carbon, whatever. So there you get a positive relation to the ferrous oxides that explain the rest, what's not explained by the stones. And especially for the black carbon content, also the hill slope plays a role. And we also did some cesium measurements, so some isotopic tracer measurements, and really found that there is erosive translocation. But apparently it's just the black carbon, due to its long residence time in soil, where this erosion really played a major role. Okay, so what's the conclusion? MIRS PLS made soil organic carbon terminal studies are made easy by this. So you can save time, you can save money just doing the PLSR thing, And it's especially important from my point of view that you don't look at too broad. So don't look at too many different locations, different climate. Just concentrate on one soil and one area. And then you have to do regionalized calibration, but the results you get are much better. And for this particular study site, there's a strong deterministic variability in soil organic carbon contents, and it seems like the amount of rock fragments here in the soil is the main driving force impacting these soil organic carbon fractions. So, yeah, so consider coarse texture whenever you look at soil organic carbon dynamics. Thank you. Yeah.
Would you show that the graph showing the difference in three loadings for the palm one?
Yes.
It looked like there were differences in other regions of that spectrum.
Yes. Yeah.
So can you really draw the conclusion that it's causal? Does that make any sense? Because you're looking at three different loadings from three different analyses, and potentially, they have different factors contributing to each one.
I'm wondering
if that's necessarily true.
Yes, I think so. Because so we have two different kind of sample sets that we compare. So we have the fractions, and the one fraction there's mainly the coarse sand, and there's in the other fraction there's maybe more of the clay in it, and the prediction models, they indicate these regions that are particular for certain carbon fractions. And the fact that in both different models, the same regions are indicated, I take this as a proof. Also, when you take a look at this one, this is here clay minerals. And you see the clay minerals are positive, of course, for the POM3. Maybe there is soil organic carbon that's sorbed to silt minerals. So you have silt and clay minerals. So you have a positive indication here for the clay, and whereas you have here a negative one. So in soil samples where there's a lot of clay, there's more sorption capacity or more protection capacity in the fine textured fractions, and so there's less carbon stored in the POM1 fraction. That's how I would interpret it. And sure, there's also information from other soil constituents, but it also sees the organic fractions. I'm pretty sure about that. Any other? Yes, please.
So just to be sure, on your last slide where you showed some of the relationships between carbon content and the stoniness.
Yeah.
You were presenting carbon concentrations, not quantities?
No, that's concentrations.
Okay, so I'm wondering if you were to look at the total carbon quantity in the profile and take into account rock fragment content and bulk densities, would the results be opposite of what you presented in terms of the spatial distribution?
Yes, I'm actually working on this, and there's a paper in preparation on this topic. And it's, of course, if you have 50% of stones, then the total amount of carbon in these stony areas, it's less than you find on the bottom position. But to my opinion, that's not actually, or not necessarily the point if you consider carbon sequestration and mechanisms of carbon sequestration. Because you always have to look at a certain amount of soil. So it may be reduced because the soldum that you consider is just 10 centimeters, or maybe it's not, or maybe it's reduced because of a huge amount of stones, whatever, so.
On that same point though, if you have less fine fraction soil volume, aren't you funneling all the carbon onto your oversaturating that?
Yes.
Compared to the lower.
Yes, that's what happened. Yeah.
So that might be why you have a differential concentration at the shoulder versus the toes, because you're forcing all the carbon onto that saturated. You're saturating it more rapidly because
yeah.
You don't have the surface to.
Yeah. Yeah, but I think you really have to be sensitive about these things. And maybe they have been forgotten by people who seed the soil and just take a look at the fine earth. That's happened to me when I first prepared all these samples and took a look at a moment. These samples are from the upper area, and there's a sandy soil, and it's much more carbon in it than in the areas with the high clay contents. And downslope position, where you would expect to have erosion enrich the soil in carbon.
Any other questions? All right. Well, thank you all for coming.
Thank you very much.